Going a little bit to the environmental issues, mm-hmm. we talked some about that, but what is the city and what is your vision as far as increasing renewables? I know BPU says is predicting 65% renewable by, I think, 2025 or 2030. Is there anything that you can envision that can actually either speed that up or increase that percentage?
Well, I mean, I think we have to be cautious when we start talking about the level of renewable energy that is in the portfolio of the BPU. You know, I served 8.5 years on the Board of Public Utilities. Mm-hmm. If you look at, currently the BPU is at 45% of its portfolio or its generation capacity is with renewables. We have to be cautious with that because a lot of that is wind energy, and if the wind is blowing at the right level, at the right rate, and in the right direction, and we're able to utilize that energy, then that would be 45%. But most mm-hmm. of the time, you know, renewables are intermittent. The issue will not be resolved until they can find a way to store the power that is generated in the off times. And I think that as we, get into more advanced battery technology, electron storage, I think there are going to be environmental concerns with that. You know, what are the batteries made of? Where are they? Where do we mine the materials that the batteries are made of? How do we, recycle the materials in there? These are going to be additional costs that I don't think anyone has looked at. In fact, I've been to several summits or conferences with public power that address all the changing industry, specifically around renewable energies and distributed generation, and that topic is never brought up. And I think we can, just as if we rushed into the carbon-based culture and were not aware of or did not pay attention to some of the environmental ramifications of that, I think we could do the same thing with battery technology. Wind energy is not without its environmental concerns, especially because it's in mm-hmm. the path of the migratory species. So there are a lot of factors that when we say green, let's dig under it. Let's really see what's possible there.
But what do you see, though, when you address these problems? How are those problems addressed, and can we address them in the same way as Greensboro, Kansas, which rebuilt after the tornado, and it's at a 100% renewable?
Yeah. Well, the unified government does not have the resources to do that level of investment. Mm-hmm. You know, they had the opportunity, if you want to call it that, and the necessity of kind of rebuilding really from mm-hmm. the ground up. We simply don't have that. I think the BPU has done a good job of, you know, starting a community solar project, which actually has not been fully subscribed. What people fail to realize, you know, when 22% of our population lives below the poverty line, they don't have a lot of resources. Mm-hmm. And environmental remediation is a very expensive proposition, especially in the last decade, because we tend to be going after a lot of very incremental improvements that we're not talking about the improvements that were great gains in environmental quality, let's say in the 70s. We're not there. Now we're reaching for these small returns that become very expensive. If you were to say, we could talk about a lot of things, but the resources to do it is something else. Because anything that the only reason the BPU was able to go to wind power was because federal tax policy allowed those developers of wind energy to make good use of those, that brought the cost down to be competitive with other forms of generation or mm-hmm. other places. So I think it's a long way to say is we don't have the money to do the kinds of thing that they did in after the tornado.
And I was going to say it would be feasible if our at national level, if we had the incentives.
It might be. I'll say this. I'm going to give you an example. Uh-huh. We had a consent an agreement with the Sierra Club because we were in violation of our opacity limits on our smokestacks. Mm-hmm. And frankly, in my opinion, the opacity limit, the regulation was written in such a way that no one could pass that. So the opacity has to do with the amount of particulate matter in your smokestack when you are firing, when you're burning coal. Mm-hmm. But those opacity limits were written in such a way that no one believed that anybody could meet those. And so every 6 seconds, a beam is shot across the smokestack and takes a reading on how opaque the air is. So they brought the lawsuit, and the lawsuit, there was no way the BP was going to expend the money to defend itself in that lawsuit. Mm-hmm. And so we just simply settled out of court. We took that money that we agreed to put renewables, and we put it to a refrigerator rebate program. Well, okay, that's a good thing, but I'm telling you, unless you have the money to go buy a refrigerator, you're not able to access that. Mm-hmm. Only people were able to access it were people who already had the money and in the market for a refrigerator. The poor were not going to be able to make use of that.
And they're the ones who already have the most inefficient refrigerators that needed replacing.
And they needed the most help. So, you know, some of these policies, not a real big fan of some of the ways we do things, because they don't take into account, for the BPU, for instance, they did not take into account our population, our demographic, and what our needs are.
Yeah. And when I said that national level, though, I was thinking in terms of right now we have an administration that has slashed subsidies and tax credits for renewables, while at the same time promoting the largest increases ever of subsidies for the coal industry.
Right. So yeah, not a big fan of subsidies in that way.
Yeah. So let me go to some of the criminal justice and juvenile justice issues. First of all, what is your vision as far as criminal justice issues and reducing crime in neighborhoods? Particularly, I think one of the big things that people are alarmed about is some of the areas where there's a lot of drug dealing.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, really the person I think who has the better take on this would be Chief Ziegler. He is trying to innovate, trying to make better use of data to identify hot spots, to intervene in those areas more effectively. We just approved our participation in a federal grant to do a unique strategy for targeting those hot spots. I think there is some concern that the argument would be made that drug offenses are they don't endanger anybody. I simply don't buy that. I had a drug house next door to me, and these were people I grew up with, and yet because it was consistently known as a drug house, there was eventually a shooting. They shot across my yard to the house next door. Mm-hmm. And you could say that, well, they were just doing drugs on their own, they're not bothering anyone. That's simply not the case. Drug use always brings with it more serious crime because the competition for the market, the gangs are competing for market share, and they will do anything they can to grab that market share, including killing one another.
And is your feeling that would still occur even if they legalized some of that drug use? And
it's going to be interesting, I think, to see, whether they've collected those stats, and I'm sure they have, mm-hmm. in Colorado. That could reduce it, but you're still going to have things like meth, and you're still going to have things like the opioids that are, people are killing over drugs. I don't think they necessarily do not bring the worst element with them.
Do you see ways of dealing with that other than the mass incarceration that our country has done for the past 30-plus years?
The way is to raise our kids well. I think it's this. You know, my experience in, and I was, as I said, the dean of students at Rockhurst High School for 19 years. And so I got to know quite a few young men who became involved in drugs at varying levels. And I've known young men from Rockhurst who have died because of their drug use. It, from a very early age, we need to raise our children to have something more and greater to be centered on and to be devoted to, so that the drugs just simply do not attract. That's comes back to individual families. That's the one way to do it. You can't hire enough police officers, and we can't build enough prisons to legislate drug use and drug activity out of existence. It can't be done. What we can do is make sure my kids are living the way they should be living.
Yeah. And I agree with that. And from my background, that's definitely what I believe has to happen.
Yeah.
But having said that, is there something at the city level and something that the state level can be doing to provide some kind of support services for families that need help to accomplish what you're saying?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how I really don't understand how government can form families. I think they put a lot of that on. I think that's one of the problems for a lot of our schools, is that the expectation is, I'm going to send my kid to this school, and now my kid comes out and he's got a problem. It's the school's fault. I heard that at Rockhurst, mm-hmm. that somehow Rockhurst was, if their kid had a drug problem, it was because their kid came to Rockhurst and got to know other kids that use drugs. Well, that's everywhere. There's just, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm not blaming the parents either. Some, you know, kids hide this stuff very well. I don't know of any unified government initiative or state initiative that can actually teach families how to raise their kids right. But I will say this, there are lots of agencies out there, private agencies and churches and school programs that do help families do the things they need to do, which then allows them to do the greater things, you know, teaching them how to be on time, teaching them what to value that is greater than just momentary pleasure.
Do you think our society would ever be ready for a mandate that when you are having your first child that you have to go to some kind of parenting classes?
I don't think so. I'm not sure I would advocate that. I think what's effective is person-to-person contact, mm-hmm. people reaching out to their neighbors, trying to be a help, being kind to the kids in the neighborhood, not letting them run around being wild. You know, mm-hmm. I wasn't allowed to run around wild in my neighborhood, and it wasn't just because of my parents. Sometimes my parents didn't even know, but the neighbors down the street would be, you know, bringing it to my attention. So,
well, one of the things that I've observed that, in my opinion, I think has been a major part of this problem, when I was a kid growing up, I was in a neighborhood like what you're describing.
Correct.
One of the problems since then, back then, you knew your neighbors.
Yes.
Most of the time, you had the same neighbors growing up.
Yes.
Whereas now, partly because of work and other reasons, neighborhoods are so transient and people moving in and out.
Right.
The people don't get a chance to know each other like they did back then.
I think that's a really very insightful, you know, analysis of what has happened. Mm-hmm. And which is, you know, as we try to work on our neighborhoods, I want to see neighbors engage neighbors, get to know one another, you know, check in on the elderly, do simple things for one another, just get some contact there, because that's what will hold a neighborhood together. We really you know, I think World War II really was the change, because after World War II, the mobility really set in. Mm-hmm. And so this is why you have subdivisions, in fact, that have limit the number of colors that you can paint the exterior of your house, and the limits, and you'll limit the number of colors you might paint the interior of your house, because you may never know when you might get moved in your job. And if you have a unique color, it's harder to sell. And so it's even showing up in how we market real estate.
Mm-hmm. And going to juvenile justice issues, mm-hmm. Well, most of the issues I think we've addressed, but we're building a new juvenile justice complex over there.
Yes.
What is the timetable for that to be completed, and what are some of the programs that they will be offering once that's built?
Yep. So I've been paying attention. We're going to be, yes, building the Juvenile Justice Center. The costs associated with that are rising. So we're actually having to present once again what we project the cost will be for that. Mm-hmm. We're in an economy right now where construction costs are rising, and because the demand is so great, and because there aren't enough people in the trades, frankly, what I think will happen is, first of all, one of the biggest effects will be it will separate the juvenile population from the adult population. And there is a way in which a prison is a learning environment. And a lot of what they learn in a jail is, or during incarceration, is not something you really want kids to learn. So I think the separation will be very helpful in that way. I also know that we are trying to focus in on working with students to make sure that we can keep them current in their school and in their coursework, that we can provide them with any drug or abuse counseling they may mm-hmm. need. We also are looking at one much more research on childhood trauma and what that does to an individual, and it really kind of rewires their brain and makes it much more difficult for them to handle frustration. They're more prone to violence. They're more prone to depression. And I think that we're becoming more aware of that and intervening earlier with children to address those problems, to get them the treatment they need. A lot of kids go through traumatic and really required post-traumatic stress mm-hmm. Treatment, and they're not getting it. And those kids are often the ones who end up back in the juvenile justice system and eventually incarcerated. So we have programs, there will be programs brought in place, and as we bring the new facility on, we'll have more facilities to do that with as well.
Is the city getting any help, grant money or anything from the state to help expand these services?
Don't know that there's any money out there available to do that. We apply for any and every grant that's out there. We're pretty much on top of it. And I would have to say probably every week I hear of a new grant opportunity or request mm-hmm. or denied or accepted. But I'm not aware of any state money okay. for that. But I'm not the best person to ask about that either.
Right. One thing that you had mentioned earlier, going back to building infrastructure and all, you alluded to maybe, besides some more hotels out in the western part, a new convention center. Is there a danger that if we build a convention center out there, that that's going to make the Reardon Center obsolete, or will there be enough of both?
So what I understand about the Reardon Convention Center is it's limited in its marketability, and it serves a lot of civic purposes. So for instance, I just recently held we held the State of the Government address there. Mm-hmm. We had the service for Deputy King there just last week. It mm-hmm. was packed, and the lines were all coursing all the way through that bottom floor of the Reardon Center. So the size of the facility out west would be much larger, mm-hmm. certainly not the size of Bartle. That's not what we're reaching for. But we know that it would serve regional and state level meetings. And there will be proposed, we're proposing a full service hotel there as well, which again is necessary to bring in convention. Conventioners like to be where there's something to do right close by. And of course, with the Legends, there are plenty of opportunities there. So that's the right spot for that.
Okay. When you say it would not be as large as Bartle, which, I mean, that's obvious. Would it be as big as maybe like the Overland Park Convention Center?
I don't think it's as large as, no, I don't think it will be as large.
Okay.
You know, I think we've got to kind of figured out the niche there, the size of the events we're looking for, and what we can accommodate and want to accommodate. And we have plenty of hotel space out there. Generally, we have the highest occupancy rate of any city in the metro area, and the highest revenues per room in the metro area at the Legends. So that's all good news, and this will only enhance it.
Going to Indian Springs, the old site, what have there been plans have been developed? I know a year ago when I talked to Mayor Holland, there were several options they were looking at, and a lot of the neighborhoods surrounding that didn't like any of the options. They wanted a green space. Of course, green space doesn't necessarily bring in revenue, so is there a plan now that's been decided on?
No, it hasn't been decided upon. Greg Kendall from the Why Not Economic Development Council, you know, he's funded through the Unified Government, the BPU, and private partners, is really seeking, again, to bring in businesses and retain businesses in Why Not County. So he's been working that site, and he has a prospective client who would like to, or person who would like to build a project there, but that's still in the works. These things take forever to develop and of course we want the revenues yesterday, but they're not coming in yesterday. You know, I think I would suggest this on the Indian Springs site. You know, the commentary before has been, well, we could have a truck stop there every day of the week, but we don't want to put a truck stop in there. I'm of the opinion if a truck stop can demonstrate that it's going to generate significant revenues, and then I'm for that, as long as that revenue stream or a good part of that revenue stream generated by that project goes right into that neighborhood to serve neighborhood needs. You know, we've almost had a disconnect between some of the developments, the big developments out west or in Fairfax. What is it doing then for the folks who live right close there? So if someone were to come to me and say, we got something that's going to generate these kinds of revenues and only requires this amount of incentives, I'd be for that if then we take those revenues and make sure we serve the needs of the residents who live within a 5-minute radius of that. I'd say, you know, I grew up in Argentine, Turner in Argentine, and on Fridays and Saturdays during the summer, I worked in a barbershop shining shoes. And I remember, you know, 1973, 1974, you know, we could walk through Argentine and get everything you needed. If I needed a inner tube for my bicycle, I'd go to Western Auto. If I needed to buy bolts, I could go to the hardware store. If I wanted to go and buy a toy, I'd go down to Dexter Toy and Hobby. We had a bakery. We had multiple restaurants, Sears catalog store, a department store. When Indian Springs opened up, that all collapsed because we got in our cars and drove to Indian Springs. So we grew up, Indian Springs was our place. And so we have an attachment to it. But times have changed. And as much as we all had an attachment to that site and what it meant for us, it's no longer that. The market doesn't support it. We have to find something that's going to support so that we can do other things elsewhere. We just can't let it sit because we don't like a particular development.
Is there some kind of development that would not create issues for the environment, though?
I don't know that there's any project that would not have some implications for the environment.
Because if you do truck stop,
right,
then you're dealing with a lot of increase in diesel emissions there.
Right, and that's correct. And I'm not proposing a truck stop. We don't have a truck stop proposal. I'm just using that as an example. Mm-hmm. If we have to find something that is going to generate revenues, because again, we can't provide some of the basic services we would like to provide elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And if we do have a project that can generate revenues and goes in that site, some of that revenue stream then must be put right back into that neighborhood, that right there. Mm-hmm. In fact, you could see where if you redeveloped the Indian Springs site, then you could also then redevelop the area just west of that, and really bring improvements to that part of State Avenue, or on the other side, which is where the old Price Chopper grocery store, the old Venture store were.
Right. All right. I think, let me just ask you a general question.
Yeah.
Is there any other issues that I haven't addressed that you would like to talk about?
No. I would say that, again, we just had the tragic deaths of Deputies King and Deputy mm-hmm. Rohrer, and I was very moved and honored to be able to see just how our community came together on that.
All right. So for those of you who have just joined us, you've been listening to Mayor David Alvey, and we've been talking about the issues over in Kansas City, Kansas, and Wyandotte County.